direct from the web, it's Billy Masters Live. And now, please welcome your host, Billy Masters.
Oh my God, another show. Hey everybody, welcome to Billy Masters Live. Of course, I am your host, Billy Masters. Thank you, Monica. Today is Thursday, April 7th. You know what? It just hit me. Tomorrow is Big Daddy's birthday. Big Daddy Masters, happy birthday, Big Daddy. Oh my God, I'm going to have to call him tomorrow. You know, David will understand. He's going to be 89. So he's got like the beginnings of like a little forgetful, like quasi-dement. So if I don't call him tomorrow, he probably won't remember. I could call him a week later and say, oh, I haven't talked to you since your birthday. I could convince him that I was a good son. Anyway, welcome to Billy Masters Live. Today, I have one of my, you know, I am so spoiled because every time I do a show, it begins with, I have one of my favorite people on here. And you know why that is? Because I only talk to people I like. If I don't like you, you're not on this show. And if you wonder how Billy feels about that person, if they're on the show, I like them. There was only, I think, only one person who has been on this show that I actively loathed. That would be a good game. Let's play, who does Billy loathe? For the most part, I can't be bothered. Hold on, I'm looking. There's already comments. Hello, Aaron Quill. And I'm sure David says the same thing. Anyway, I'm making my comments larger because really got old during the pandemic. My guest today, I don't even know, you know, it's so funny because there are people who I know and the people who have written memoirs and people who, you know, I've seen their shows, like Sam Harris. How many times have I had Sam Harris on the show? And yet there's always more to ask. Well, this is another person. I have known David Pevsner probably close to 20 years. I think he was one of the first friends I made out here. He's certainly one of the few people out there who has slept in this bed. I can say that with certainty because I don't let people stay the night. Like it's chew and screw, really, frankly. Or chew, screw, and then screw. But I adore David Pevsner. He has written a new book. I have a Chiron here, which is A Damn Shame, a memoir of desire, defiance, and show tunes, as all good memoirs should be. Please welcome my friend, David Pevsner.
Hello, hello.
Hey, David, how are you?
I'm good, but let's clear one thing up right away.
Oh, yeah.
I sublet your apartment. That's why.
That's true. No, yes. Oh, yeah. We did. I certainly did not want to imply that we had sex or that any money exchanged hands. Although I guess money kind of did exchange hands. But
sure, why not?
Actually, it went directly to the landlord. Oh, my God. You slept with my landlord. And I will say, David, and I can say this with certainty, that David left my apartment cleaner than when he arrived.
Probably,
it's
yeah.
Kind of what he does. You know, if you get the opportunity to trick with David Pevsner, you are in for a cavalcade of skills.
That's true, because afterwards, I might just organize your apartment.
Right.
I may start making suggestions about, you know, that bookcase and, ooh, your kitchen. Yeah.
You know, if you had a cubby here. Yeah. Because you are a man of many talents. You're a writer, you're a performer, you are a composer, you are an organizer, a cleaner, have been a naked maid, have been a model. I don't know, what else have you done?
That's
a lot. Something else.
I'm sure, you know, I always say that I have done everything there is to do for money, and I mean everything, so...
And very little for free.
What'd you say?
Very little for free.
Yeah. No. Well, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, we will. You know, I saw your one-man show, which was, well, it was at one point called Musical Comedy Whore. It then, for Amazon, became Musical Comedy Stud.
Yeah, for Amazon streaming, I had to change it to Musical Comedy Stud because it's a family venture.
Yeah, well, all right.
But it's still Musical Comedy Whore if you want to get the DVD.
Right. And I was actually at the filming, now that I think of it. I saw it several times during the incarnation. And so as somebody who is working on a memoir right now, I always like reading memoirs, particularly people who I know, because I'm curious how about the process. And in your case, I'm wondering, since you had written a show previously, did that help or impede the book? Because there are some parts of the book that really feel very musical and that they have the arcs and the same punch as the show did. But did that also hold you back a little bit?
No, actually, I mean, the two shows that I did that were both autobiographical were kind of like the skeleton of the book in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they did run consequently and that's not the word I was looking for. Oh, I'm so old.
Consecutively.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And so, you know, when, so I was able to kind of use those as like the basis, but there's so much more, as you know, beyond it, before it, during it. And what my editor said to me was, David, what plays on the stage doesn't necessarily play on the page. So I had to do a lot of work to make it a little more literary, a little bit more. But the good news was there were so many details and funny stories and kind of touching moments that I could include now that you couldn't do on stage because you don't have right.
Because the opposite works is that what doesn't work on the stage does work on the page.
Yeah, that was a great process, kind of feeling these things out a little bit more, filling them out. And then, you know, it's not, I don't just take from the show and throw it in the book, you know, that's,
right.
But there's, again, there's so much more beyond what the stories in the shows are.
Yeah. I'm curious when you started writing the book, were there moments that you went, oh, I finally tell this story or this
absolutely.
One. I was so upset I had to lose this in the show, but here's where it fits.
Absolutely. And not only that, when I was really in it, because, you know, I always say my memory's not great. But when I was really focused on the storytelling, suddenly something would be like, oh, my God, that guy. Oh, I have to tell that story. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I would get like an emotional reaction to just the remembrance of it. So mm-hmm. in that case, I knew that it was something I had to include in the book. And since everything in the book, it's not just, you know, I did this, then I did this, then I did that. It everything is tied to the themes of body shame, sexuality, and ageism. So mm-hmm. that helped to focus the storytelling even more for me. And I felt
if there were stories that didn't suit that narrative, did you have to then find a way into that story?
Either that or bye-bye. Because
really?
Yeah, because you know, I wanted the book to have resonance beyond just my own story. You know, mm-hmm. I wanted it to be bigger than my story. And I found that the way to do it was to keep going back to those themes. And there's a couple of things that maybe aren't exactly on theme, but they certainly color the picture of little David who grew up to be this, you know, and who ended up doing the naked maid and the escorting and the modeling. And, you know, you kind of had to know me as a little boy to see how far this all takes me, you know.
You know, there was, you know, two things. First, it reminded me of something Nia Vardalos once told me, who wrote My Big Fat Greek Wedding, yeah. which originally started as a one-person show just up the street from this apartment.
Yeah.
Which is that people kept telling her to make it more universal until one person said to her, you don't understand, the more specific it is to you, the more universal it is to everybody.
Absolutely. I found.
And I said, wow, how smart.
The more honest I became and the more specific, the more detailed, the more finding things that really, you know, were why I should write this book rather than somebody else, you know, the more I found in when I was doing readings of it, you know, originally I thought, well, this is going to resonate with 60-year-old gay men, you know, mm-hmm. originally. But then as I started to put it out, I had so, and with my show also, people were saying, did not have your experience, but I had something like it. And boy, did it touch me, or it made me feel a certain way about myself through your story. So I was like, if you can capture that, you know, you could do a show about penguins in Guam, but if you make it so that it's relatable, and it's, and that people will get something from it that maybe relates to them, that they see themselves either in the book or on stage, I think you've got gold.
So I had an aha moment about that. You talk about this book. Okay, explain to people this book, please.
Okay, so this is the book. Instead of having the talk about the birds and the bees, mm-hmm. my father handed me this book, For Boys Only, by Frank Howard Richardson, M.D. And so I read this book, but because
the mysteries of manhood, let's not forget the subtitle.
The mysteries of my manhood. Well, so I'm reading this book, and I know that I'm inside. I know that there's something different about me, that I'm a little mm-hmm. gay boy. And so I kind of thought, does it have anything about homosexuality in it? Mm-hmm. Because that was the first thing I wanted to know. So I took it into my room and I went back and looked. Homosexuality, yes, there's pages. And on those pages, it talks about how, well, be careful because there are probably older men out there who are going to want to play around with you, and you don't want that to happen. And it got into all this predator stuff. And I was like, oh my God. And that's what it talks about in terms of homosexuality. It doesn't even say the words in the book, only in the index. Huh. But in the book, you go there and it's all this stuff about how older men are going to want to diddle with you. Or, I mean, so what does that do to a kid who doesn't even know what's going on?
And you're roughly how old?
Oh, God, I must have been about 11.
Okay, yeah. So I had a similar experience I had talked about in my one-man show, which had also taken place at the Bailiwick Theater. So you and I have lived very parallel lives in so many ways. And I did a show called Going Out on a Limb. And you there were things you don't think about until you're going to do a show. And I remembered this, you know, I was probably maybe 15, 14, 13, early teens. And I saw this book in a bookstore, The Sensuous Man by M. So M was so filled with shame, he didn't even want his name. And was probably a woman. But anyway, so because The Sensuous Woman had come out, and then The Sensuous Man, which I don't think sold. And I used to have a copy of it. I don't hear. But in the show, I remember picking it up. And one of the first, you know, it's about guys having confidence to be with women and how to approach women. And in the first page, it says something like, I'm paraphrasing M. It says, and don't worry about your body shape or if you're handsome or not. Only fags need good bone structure. And I went, oh my God, I'm sunk. And you don't think about it, but that is a message that stays with you for decades.
Absolutely.
And so you talk about body dysmorphia and stuff, these things are rooted in messages that we are given as children.
Well, also, you don't realize, like at the time when my dad gave me that book, and it may have been 12 or 13, I don't remember, but it was written, I look now, in 1952, and I'm reading it in 19.
And you were how old? All right,
you bitch. I'm reading it in like 1970, 71, where, you know, the sexual revolution was happening and people were being a little bit more honest about it. But he hands me a book from 1952 because he just, look, I love my father. My father was the best. But when it came to talking about sex, that was not something that my parents wanted to do with me. So it was like, here, take this, you know? And that's the first kind of explanation I had about anything going on inside of me. And yes, it does scar you because at the time you don't realize, all you go is like, oh, they're going to want to play with me. And I don't know if I want that from somebody old, you know, like, and what, you know, like what you had with that.
I'm not handsome enough. Right.
Yeah. You even read the word faggot. It's like shocking, but you kind of go, well, but it's in a mainstream book and, you know, M wrote it. So who knows?
Exactly. So, you know, The beginning and end of your book, I'm going to kind of start with, because the end of the book kind of ends the way your show ends. It ends with the same words, ends the same song. It ends with the same message. Yeah. And, you know, I'm curious, and the message being that you're basically worthwhile. You're worthy of love. And that, because the song is, go ahead.
I got to give it up to love.
Right. But it, the last line is?
Well, the one who needs to hear these words about feeling fulfilled is me. You know, and I get there in a different way than the book. It's a little more involved the way that I get there,
right?
Because I have to be more delicate about saying that the ending of this book is kind of bittersweet. I don't get to the end of the book and I'm like, hey, I'm great, I'm fine, I know everything. Still a work in progress. Still trying to love myself and be kind to myself, which I don't do all the time.
No, well, none of us do, I don't think.
Right. So that's the point of the end, is that, like, you got to try and get there. You're not going to get there tomorrow. You may never get there 100%, but you can still wake up, stop the negative back talk, stop, you know, judging yourself so much, stop judging others so much, mm-hmm. and just live and experience life, take it in, try to find joy. You know, it's,
see, now I take it a little differently. And again, that's the good thing about songs and books, is that everybody reads it differently. Is that I remember when I saw the show and the song would end with, I found a wonderful guy. Yeah. And at the end of the show, you, at least the way I took it, is I found in myself a wonderful guy.
Absolutely.
That I'm a wonderful guy. I don't have to look for that in someone else. And
but the difference in the show, mm-hmm. where it's the lyric of the song, I found myself a fabulous guy, which I sing a lot. You know, I found myself, but in a very kind of benign way. But at the end, the idea, yes, is that I have found myself a fabulous guy, and that guy is me. I don't say that guy is me. But in the book, I say, I found myself. And then I go away from the lyric and say, or at least I'm finding myself a fabulous guy. The journey continues, you know, in the show, I need to end it.
Yeah. So do you feel taking out, you know, the structure and the way it was written, do you feel the same way at the end of your book as you felt it when writing the show, or have you changed?
I've definitely changed, because I'm a little more open to the idea that I'm still a work in progress, you know? And at the end of the book, I hope that people will feel the same way, that you never stop learning, you never stop exploring yourself, you know, your fantasies, this, that, the other thing. So because the book was so much about these themes of body shame, sexuality, and ageism, I do feel a little different at the end of the book. And I do feel like I wrote it differently, because I don't really talk, I mean, I talk about shame in the show for sure, but the book really goes into the various kinds of shame, you know.
And what causes it and what it causes in you.
Yeah. And I'm not an expert. All I do is I share my experiences and how they affected me. But
you're no M.
I'm no M, absolutely. Or W, who wrote The Sensuous Woman, I guess. I don't know who wrote that. But the point of the matter is that I, in my honesty, I'm brutally honest in this book.
Yeah.
I'll say that to anybody, because I felt like the only way that I could get to that universal thing is to be truly honest about my situation. You know, and I never had.
Yeah, you don't project, I have to say. You don't really. You only, I mean, aside from, there are times in relationships where you muse where somebody else's reaction is coming from.
Right.
But you really let that go and say, but why did I react this way?
Yeah, because I feel like it's the kind of thing they always say, that when you do any work of art, you want to make people feel less alone. You want them to feel like there's, you know, that somebody understands what they're going through. And I believe, because I've been so brutally honest in this book, and, you know, I'm not always kind to myself during the book. I'm kind of judgmental.
Not at all.
Yeah. But I feel like in reading that people will kind of go, oh, wow, it's okay then that I did so-and-so, and I've been beating myself up for years about that, and I need to stop, you know?
Right. And the other thing is, at the very beginning, let's just discuss, who is Marcia?
Marcia was my mother. And what's that called? The word?
The dedication.
The dedication. Oh my God, I'm so senile. The dedication is to Marcia Pevsner, the best storyteller ever.
And because what made her the best storyteller?
First off, she was hilarious. Like all my friends, even when I was having a hard time with my folks as a teenager, all my friends loved her. They would sit at the kitchen table and just listen to her tell stories because she was really funny. She was really smart. And she never had that sense of, I'm going to tell a story faster because I'm going to lose my audience.
Oh, okay. You know, she did it at her own pace.
She did it at her own pace. And she used to do things like she would go, like my favorite story ever was she would go, when the book Sophie's Choice came out, and I'm going to do a visual on my computer, okay? But she would go, they say, and she had kind of a Chicago accent. They say that Sophie's Choice is the ultimate book on the Holocaust. You know why not? Because Sophie wasn't Jewish. And that was it. And people would be like, oh God, Mom. I mean, she was just so funny, so active. And
I also love when, you know, even later in life, when they would come to New York to see you in shows, both your parents, but particularly your mother, and your friends would hear about them before they met them. And then they take you aside and say, who are you talking about? This woman is fantastic.
Absolutely. Because, you know, when you're a kid and even when you're a young adult, you're just like, get out of my face. You know, let me be me. And they really, once I came out to them, they weren't, you know, they weren't like, I got them to my side very quickly. And they did a lot of education so that they understood. They didn't want to talk about the sexual aspect of it. That's for sure.
Although, I'm going to push back a little bit, but it's not talking. It's writing. Tell the story about your knapsack. And the your mom left.
I think you were
visiting from New York.
Right.
For like a weekend or something.
Right. And I would go back to Chicago periodically. And when I'd go to Chicago, I would escape to the bars in, you know, the Lakeview area and Andersonville, sure. Boys Town. And I would go, and this was in my 20s, and was just very like adventurous. Once I kind of built myself up and everything, I went and I'd go to the bars, I would go to the bathhouses, I would hook up, and sometimes I would roll into the house at like 5 a.m. with my, you know, having taken my dad. And my father was up very early every day. So I would come in at 5 a.m. and there he was, you know, sitting reading the paper, and he'd be like this. So one time I was leaving and I check in my backpack and there was a note, and it was my mother. And she wrote like on rulers. So she would send a note, but she would do it really straight lines, you know?
Right.
And I don't remember the exact words of the whole note, but it said something like, it was questioning my behavior. And it said, you could get, she was afraid that you could get AIDS, and then in really big, dark letters, or worse. And I was like, what's worse than AIDS? But I think she meant like, you know,
die. Oh, killed. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think that's what she meant. So I had that note for years. And when I was putting this book together, I was looking for it. I keep everything, but I couldn't find that note because at the time I was like, but then like a few years later, I just thought it was hilarious because they really cared. They couldn't come out and talk to me and say, we worry about your behavior and just be careful. Mm-hmm. She stuck a note in my knapsack and I discovered it. And, you know, my mom and dad were the best. They were the best. We didn't maybe talk about certain things, but I knew that I would never lose their love no matter what I did. And I did some stuff that tested it, you know.
Yeah, well, the one thing I found so interesting was that, you know, you were, you were two things at the same time, as of course we all are. On one hand, you want to be accepted, you want to be acknowledged, you want them to see everything. But on the other hand, you're like, oh, do I really want them to see this show? Or I know this is going to be hard for them and this is going to be a problem, but I still want them to see it. And I love the story when your mom went to New York to see you in Party, which was written by our friend David Dillon.
Yes. Yeah. So my mom, originally when I told her I got the show, first off, Party started in Chicago, where my folks are from, where they live. Mm-hmm. And so when I got the New York production of it, which was kind of a big deal, it was going to be a high profile off-Broadway show. I said to my mom, Mom, so I got a role in this new off-Broadway show that actually played in Chicago before. Maybe you've heard of it. It's called Party. She goes, Party? Party? I don't know Party. So I get the gig. I tell her what it is, because in the end, by the end of the show, everybody's naked. Okay. Right. It's kind of a truth or dare thing. And it's very fun and very, you know, kind of heartwarming and everything. And my mom was like, well, you have to excuse me if I don't come to see this one because I'm not comfortable. She said, I don't care about seeing everybody else naked. I just don't want to see you naked on stage. And I was like, I understand. I totally understood. I wasn't going to force anything.
Sure.
So she's coming to New York for a convention for her women's Jewish organization. And she said, I would like to come see the show.
To bring like, some of the gals.
No, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Miriam would love it. So she said to me, so I know you're only naked in the last 5 minutes of the show. Tell me a cue that I can leave that. So I'll just leave during that. I was like, that's fine. That's fine. So at the show, it turns out that if she left, it would open the darkness of the door and light would slice in. And so she was like, I can't do it. So she was stuck. And I didn't realize that, but she was stuck. So she watched the rest of the show like this. And then she
Only like 5 minutes.
5 minutes.
Right? Yeah.
But then she looked over at the fire sign, you know, the behind the plexiglass that shows where the fire marshal comes and everything. And she could see the lead guy reflected. So she watched the rest of the show like this. The lights went black. She went like this. And finally, I had a robot. So she did her due diligence coming to see me in a show. It wasn't her favorite thing that I've ever done, but she came. And it was the same thing with Naked Boys Singing.
I was just going to say, there was a show she liked even less.
Oh, my God, yeah. So when I wrote, you know, I wrote songs for Naked Boys Singing, and it became this big, huge hit. And when I was in, so I tell a pretty funny story about her listening to the songs with me in the book. That's just, it goes just south because of how, there's a line in one of the songs, The Perky Little Porn Star, where he talks about how he can get over his guilt and be a porn star. And the line is...
And he is from Skokie, Illinois.
Like, so that my mom, when she listened to this song, she was like, oh, this is probably true. And there's a line in the thing where it goes, you know, how he can continue to do it and not feel guilty. He goes, I continue giving head and pretend that mom is dead and my conscience and my sphincter can relax. So we're both listening. We played it on
David, you got an imagination.
But we're playing it on the CD-ROM. They didn't have a CD player. And my computer, we're staring at the computer, a radio in the 1940s. She hears that lyric and she goes, like that. That's it. We didn't talk about any of it, but she did come to see the show. And afterward, I asked her how she liked the show. I asked her if she liked the show, and she goes, oh no. Like she was smelling like bad sweat and cheese.
But she went.
She was something else. My mom was the best, truly.
And you lost her recently. How many years?
Yeah, ago? Just 2019.
I mean, really, it's and again, I as somebody whose parents are still alive and in their 80s.
I'm sorry, 2017. My dad was 2019.
Well, that's what I was going to get to, is that, you know, my dad is going to be 89. My mom's going to be 81. Oh, wow. And so I'm reading this and I'm like, you know, this is, again, the universality of it. And how you said, well, she died and I kind of expected that at least I'd have dad. That didn't happen.
No. You know, usually, look, my dad was very, had a lot of life in him, was just as ornery as could be. And we thought after my mom passed that, you know, he would go on and on and on.
Yeah.
But as often happens with people who are together for so many years, 65 years, my parents, they were married 65 years. They, you know, he passed 13 months later, and and he had liver bile duct cancer. But when my mom passed, at least I knew nothing about that. And I believe that the cancer was triggered when he lost her.
In response to his grief.
I believe that, you know,
yeah.
Because then it was fast. Both of my parents, you know, there wasn't a lot of time between.
Well, both of them died of cancer. What kind of cancer did your mom have?
Well, she had various kinds.
Oh, okay.
You know, that she had been dealing with over the years, you know.
Oh, really? So hers was in the ether, as they say.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, my high school girlfriend came up to me at the Shiva for my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And she gave me a kiss. And she said, well, you're in the orphan club. And then she goes, it's a really shitty club to be in. And I just started bawling because, you know, I thought my parents were going to go on forever because they were those.
Right, of course.
They had such surroundings of like, they did everything. People loved them. They had tons of friends. They traveled. They just did everything. And I just thought they were going to go on forever. And I think I took that for granted.
Yeah, I it's funny. I have a friend who, you know, will say to people, my mom died unexpectedly at 88. And they're like, well, did you think she was going to live to 108? You know, but you don't think of it that way. And having older parents, I understand. I want to go back to Party, because Party was also came at a time in your life where the escorting began.
Right.
And, you know, I, you know, you've been so open with people. I don't even remember, frankly, when I knew you escorted, but, and there was never, I don't think, a conversation. It just, well, also given the people I'm friends with, who would think it would be an issue. But I'm curious what led you, you know, now that you look back on reflection, was it sort of a perfect storm of developing the body, having the insecurity, getting the attention, getting paid, the danger of it, the taboo? I mean, did everything kind of hit at the same time?
You pretty much captured it. And then it was, now because I was 36 years old at the time, nothing is going to happen.
Which seems so young right now.
I know, but back then it wasn't.
Yeah, you were old.
In the 90s. And right. So I think it was the thing that brought it to the perfect storm was the ad that I saw in HX magazine for a service called Maturity Escorts, actively looking for older guys to be male escorts.
Mm, which was rare.
Which was very rare. You know, everybody was 22 years old and, you know, GQ-y looking or porn starry looking. And because
I have to interrupt for a second, just put in historical context. We had come out of a time where people in their 30s and 40s either didn't look so hot or were dead.
Right.
So, I mean, it was suddenly there were these guys who had survived HIV and were thriving and looked good. And we had older guys that we could be attracted to and were kind of role model-y for a lot of younger gay men.
Absolutely. And being one of those guys that made it, you know, to my 30s or my late 30s, I still was buying into the whole thing about the body being, you know, had to be perfect, that our community was so, you know, kind of judgmental about physicality.
Right.
And so when I went, built up my body to pass, you know, when I could make it into the glitz of the Gatorade, up here, I was still kind of the skinny, ugly Jewish kid.
Sure.
So the escorting came about because not only was I not making enough money off Broadway, even though I was getting more attention for shows than I ever had, but right. I wasn't making enough money. But it really wasn't the money. It was can I be the kind of guy that somebody would pay money to have sex with? It was something I wanted to find out. And rather than go about my life going, gee, I wonder what would have been, I saw that ad and went, boop, and it was time. And I dove in, had the interview, which was bonkers.
Yeah, and I'm not going to get into it, but and in the show, I mean, people, you really need to get the DVD in the book, because you describe things in the book very vividly and very cinematically, but you actually could see you reenacting the interview in the one-man show.
The audiobook version of it, being able to read it myself, was also really fun.
Oh, I don't have that.
Well, it was a lot of fun. But it was just, you know, I got the gig and it was not what I expected. I loved it.
But what's so interesting and not surprising, I guess, to me, because of the people I know and you know, is that the more of these hurdles you jumped yourself through, there were sex parties that would only let you in if you passed muster with like a council with looping saying, that's not so good. And, you know, and then you'd say, oh, I'm going to do this because if I get past this, then I must be okay. Well, no matter how many times you do that, you never think to yourself, oh, well, now I'm done jumping through hoops because I must be fabulous. You never got to that point. So important for people to know that, you know, external validation is great. I think if you don't have insecurities, and I don't know who doesn't have insecurities, but, you know, I used to say to people that would say, oh, you know, if I had that boyfriend, I would be so happy for the rest of my life. And I'd say, do you know that somebody has that boyfriend? And he's like, oh, that old thing, because it is perspective. And you think everybody else's lives are better, and they're not. And they all have these insecurities. And usually the ones making you jump through those hoops have more than you have.
Oh, absolutely. And I tell a lot about how during that period, especially first coming to New York and, you know, all these men, all this stuff, how you were just always looking. I was always looking for something better. I could never settle on anything because, you know, so if I could get that guy, I could probably get that guy. And it was
right.
You know, when I think about how small-minded I was back then, it was just what I had to do.
And we all are, though. But, oh, we got a comment first. Bruce Steele said, I just downloaded the audiobook. Can't wait to listen.
Bruce. Hi, Bruce. Steele. Oh, my God.
One of our OGs, really.
Was like a conduit person. When I came out to L.A., I mean, I met Bruce back in New York. In fact, Bruce introduced me to the ex that I talk about in the book.
Reed.
But so I've known Bruce a long time. But when I got to L.A., they were very much, you know, I lived next door to them for a little while.
Bruce and Chris.
Yeah, I lived in.
Oh, we should say, okay, Bruce was editor at Out Magazine at that time.
Yeah, I think so.
But has worked in gay media and, you know, for quite some time.
Yeah, and, back in LA now, which is
back in LA. Thank God, I know. Anyway, so it is a small world, and again, you know, what's interesting about your story is, and again, I think to myself, maybe it's because I live in LA, I know porn stars, I've dated hookers, I mean, so these are my people, and you do think, you know, that. When I have found, this may be so shallow of me, so please forgive me, people. But if you're watching this show, you know I'm a shallow bitch. That I would think that if I date that person, somehow you're attaining those qualities of them that you covet, and it gives you this power. And what very often happens is the absolute opposite, which is because you have it now, you will never keep it because they're going to see through you. There is that imposter syndrome that actors talk about. And just because you were lucky enough to get, you talk about going to the sex parties, just because you were lucky enough to pass muster and get in, you got there and said, but no one's looking at me because I'm the scrawny Jew with the big nose in the corner who's 120 years old.
Yeah,
I'm
well,
paraphrasing.
It all comes down to, if you're not good with yourself, you'll, you know, it doesn't matter who you're with or what you're doing. You're not going to, you know, you look for validation in the wrong places when you got to look for it from yourself first and foremost.
Yeah. And again, going back to the end of your book, is that you have found that wonderful guy in yourself, that you can't look for somebody else to fix you.
No,
you're fine. But none of us are really fine. I mean, that's how we feel. And none of us are fine. And there's no way you could be.
I had a friend that I went on tour with, and I was, she joined the tour, and I was so glad because she's one of my favorite people in the world. But after a while, I was like, I got angry with her because there was no bad, nothing was bad. Like, everything was great. And so when something was kind of not great on my end, I didn't feel like I could talk to her about it because she would go, but, oh, it's going to be fine. You know, I don't trust that. I don't trust that, you know, people, that everything is fine in everybody's life. You know, you see it on Facebook, you see it on Twitter, and everything's great. But I just, you know, and I know that people don't want to advertise when their lives are not going well. I totally get that. But in a personal relationship, if, you know, if everything's hunky-dory all the time, I can't, you've got to go deeper with me, and you got to let me give you the good and the bad. Otherwise, I don't know how I can be friends with you, like real friends, you know?
You know, somebody, a friend of ours, I'm not going to name him, but an actor who works somewhat regularly, had written a post, I don't know, like 2 months ago. I had told so many people about this post that he said, I am down to $235 in the bank. Does anyone have an idea of what I can do aside from acting, because I'm not getting calls and even retail, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, there was that part of me, it's go, oh, how sad, but why is he putting that out there? And somebody else said, well, why shouldn't he?
He's
asking for help. And so I, again, was projecting, oh, I would never want people to look at me like that. But we all are like that.
Absolutely. Look, I've got, you know, I got a producer for my CD by putting out on Facebook looking for a producer, you know? I mean, it's the kind of thing that I think, but see, that's where you said the judgmental aspect comes on. If you've got the balls to go in a social situation and say, I need help. If you've got the balls, then it is not for us to say, oh, how sad. It's us to say, good for you. And if I think of something, I will send it your way. Mm-hmm. You know, because what level of desperation are people at that they want to do that? Or is it just kind of like, I don't know what to do? And if that's
yeah,
the case,
I have a friend who regularly, well, not regularly, but occasionally will put out on Facebook, any of my friends reading this, I'm still looking for work. And I'll roll the eyes. Oh my God, I hate for people to see you like that. And yet each time he does it, he gets a call for work.
So there you go. So who is it for us to say, you know, oh, poor guy, or, you know, whatever. Just like, people got to do what they got to do. My friend Kent Gash, who I love to death, always said to me, if there's anything physically that you can do to make your life better, then do it.
Right.
And that falls under that caption, you know. I mean, I'm trying to think if I've ever done anything in such a social way. No, I don't think so. But I mean.
But you would.
I would. And telling my story, too. You know, I put out that I was a male escort, that I'm an erotic model, that I have videos, you know, porn videos that I've started working on, this, that, the other thing. And it used to be I was so kind of like, don't talk about it because people are going to judge me. And now.
And people did. That's the other thing. You survived that. That's
totally.
You know, there are times that, you know, there was one agent who's your commercial agent who said, oh, we got a call that you're doing this. Can you take it down? No. OK, never mind. Which then made you proactive to call your theatrical agent. Theatrical.
Right. My theatrical
and agent. Say, hi, I just want you to know
that I have this out there. And then they both dropped.
That's fine. No problem. We support you. And then 2 months later, dropped you anyway.
Yeah. Look, I get it. There's nothing in the book where I'm like, you bitches. No, not at all.
No, that second one, you totally were like, I get it, because I probably wasn't bringing in much money.
Yeah, at the time. And so I was, whatever the case, whatever they dropped me, I get it, because as I talk about in the book, it gets back to the polarization of sex and how people, sex and nudity and how the opinions run the gamut. And sometimes it's that fundamentalist, right-wing, horrible thing. And sometimes it's just, I'm not used to this. I think it's private and I think it should be private. Well, obviously I don't. And what I'm trying to kind of fight for, my mission is that sex and nudity should not be treated with such disgust and such vehemence. And it, I don't think it should be used to judge you when it comes to getting hired for a job or, you know, or a relationship. Oh, my God.
Well, that's the other thing. So we'll get to Reed in a second. But, you know, I'm going to even go one step further, universality. It's about being authentic to who you are. And one of the biggest blow ups in my Reed, named Alex, also in New York. I remember when I first met him, you know, as we all do, you're trying to be who they want. Well, eventually they're going to see who you are, and either they want that or they don't. And you can't be who somebody else wants 24/7 long term. It's never going to last. And as hard as that was, and I'm like, well, you don't love me. And he's like, well, I loved the you I met. I don't know who this is. And I'm like, oh, well, that's who I always was. So bye-bye.
No, and it's difficult if you can't bring your authenticity to a relationship. I always say that the person I'm going to be with is the one that we meet. We hate each other. We have to work together, that we see the worst of each other right up front. And then when we kind of work through that, all of a sudden we'll be like, oh, you're really great. I'm glad I saw that side of you at first. That's kind of how I feel like it might go for me at some point, but because it hasn't really till now. But
so let's talk about Reed. You know, Reed, you dated, were you in party at the time?
No.
Just out of party.
I was out of party.
Okay. But you were escorting.
I was.
And you were not upfront about it at first.
Not right away, but pretty quickly. Because we ended up spending a lot of time. Once we met, we spent a lot of time together. And
what was it about him that made you think this could be the one?
He was so different from anybody I'd ever dated before.
In what way?
I always dated kind of body guys, you know, and he wasn't that. Okay.
You were still attracted to him.
I was attracted to him. And I think part of the attraction was really smart, really, you know, he's a film composer and talented, which talent to me is always sexy, you know.
Right. And you had music in common as well.
Music in common, right. And so the connection was just really fast. And I was up, I was looking to change my ways, you know, and he happened to, because I had always kind of dated, once I built myself up, that's what I was looking for. And I was getting the same guys as I was, a neurotic built guy who doesn't really know who he is or what he wants.
Sure.
Then I started escorting and I had sex with a lot of men who were certainly not that. And certainly not, you know, when you're told who you're going to have sex with, you kind of have to open your mind or else you can't do the job. And I found that I started focusing on other things about men because I had some wonderful clients, you know, physically not always what I was looking for in outside of it, but it didn't matter because I was, you know, they needed warmth. They needed comfort. They were funny. Some had a big dick, you know, whatever it was that kind of drew me to them. I had to look beyond what was going on in face value in order to make a connection. And I found that I was learning how to make a connection with guys who weren't my physical type.
But could you see yourself dating any of those people?
You know, somebody asked me if I ever fell in love with a client. Okay. I've never fell in love, but I fell in tremendous like with some of them, and had it been outside of escorting with the foundation that I established with some of them, potentially, okay. But it was very separate. No,
right.
But then Reed comes along, and he's not the typical guy that I usually would date.
recreationally.
Recreational, yeah.
So, how did your revelation change the relationship?
I think he thought when he met me, because I was escorting, that I was still that guy who was going to fall for the next, you know, pair of pecs that came. So he was insecure about it.
Right.
I was there to say, no, I'm so happy to be with you. I am so thrilled that I found this. And because I'd been an escort, I think he just thought that's what I always was. I was a talker. Mm-hmm. I was a schmoozer. I was a
hooker mentality.
Right. And anybody who knows me and has known me, or look, I'm sure you know some male escorts. I did it my way. I'm a certain kind of person. They do it their way. They're a certain kind of person.
Right. They're not all the same.
No. And the stereotype of hustler, you know, you say hustler and you think that you're always on the hustle and that you know, you do drugs and that you got a libido of, you know.
And some do.
And some do, but some don't.
That's correct. You know?
And so I did it my way. I can't speak for how everybody else does it. I did it my way. And I was always kind of a caretaker type. And so I brought that in and I could have a conversation because, you know, I'm a fairly smart guy and I find humor wherever I can. So, you know, I brought all of that to the table when I met with guys. That's how I did it. Right. And so I was not going to be shamed about the fact that I did it. It started
Except
out.
Except you were.
With him, I was.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. Because he made me
feel. You were more vulnerable.
He made me feel like I wasn't good, like I wasn't as good as him. He who knows how to do relationships and me who don't.
But you know what was interesting reading it? And I don't know him. And am I correct in saying Reed is not his real name?
Reed is not his real name.
Okay.
Let's
call him Reed. Right. Yeah. No, it's fine. So, but what was so interesting in his attacks, both the first time when you told him and he kind of broke up with you and then you ended up getting back, and then the last time, is that he seems to be attacking you for the things that attracted him to you.
Yeah.
That he's talking about, oh, why do you have to look like a hooker? And why do you have to have that body and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, well, why did you hit on me? You know? And so that seems to have had to have been under the surface the whole time. And yet it did last, what, 14, 16 months?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he could profess to say that he knows how to do relationships. He's more interested in the mind. But I know for a fact it was my body that first got him. I know it, you know. Maybe it was a combination, but the body had a lot to do with it.
Well, I always say that in a bar, you don't see somebody's personality. You don't see somebody's intellect. You're attracted by the face or the body. But it takes those other things to keep them talking to you. Unless
Absolutely.
You're just looking to hook up, in which case, just a body is fine.
Well, and at the end of the relationship, he could refer to me as a trophy boy. Yeah, and I was like, first off, I'm 9,000 years old. Secondly, it's not like I'm a GQ model or anything like that. But he tried to belittle me by saying all I was after all this time we were together was just this physical
arm candy. Yeah.
And yeah, exactly. And I wasn't, it's not like I was, like, I never considered myself that good looking or that well built.
But maybe he did.
Maybe he did.
Yeah. You know, that's what I got out of it, was that, you know, whenever you're attacked, it really says more about the other person's issues than your.
And I didn't know that until the end of the relationship.
Well,
that's where I learned.
Had you known that earlier, could you have made that work, or would you have ended it?
And I would have gone.
Okay.
Because I say later on, you know, and even now when I see how people are in relationships, and sometimes they're very, you know, even if they've been together 20, 25 years, they're very respectful. There's, you know, they get little tips, but the ones who talk to each other like, I can't believe you fucking did that again. And you're such an idiot. Somebody talked to me that way, I'd be out of there as fast as possible. And I learned that from how he spoke to me back then.
Which is interesting, because at the very beginning he was doing that and you were begging him to take you back.
Yeah.
So your self-worth and your state of mind was so different at the very beginning. And also, one thing that I just kept thinking as I read the book, I'm like, boy, I'm hearing, even taking the escorting completely out of the equation, I'm hearing a lot about tricks and hot guys and recreational sex, but I'm not hearing about relationships.
Yeah.
And, you know, you say when you get to read, you're probably thinking to yourself, where have the boyfriends been? Well, I was wondering too.
No, there's
one. So that was your vulnerability.
Once that relationship was done, I was like, I am not getting into another shit show like that. Yeah. So I didn't have a relationship for years. And so that was part of it. The other part was, as a struggling artist and not making a lot of money, it is not fun to date people, to put yourself out there when you don't have money. That was my attitude back then. And it was, so I went many, many years without, you know, a real, without a relationship at all. And I was kind of okay on my own because I'm kind of an introvert and I'm kind of a loner, you know, so that, but as I've gotten older and as I've let a lot of that go, I mean, I hate to say that at 63, I'm finally ready for a relationship, but I think I am, because I honestly don't know, had I had a real relationship before, like the events of the book, I don't know that I would have handled it well.
Well, we never know.
Really want it.
Yeah, we never know that there is so much timing involved, that this person, had they come into your life 20 years later, might have been the person. We should just mention again, David Pevsner's book is called Damn Shame, a memoir of desire, defiance, and shojuns. And there's a lot of defiance. You do have a lot of rage and a lot of anger that comes out in very positive ways. You channel it well, but it's definitely there. And some of it is targeted at yourself in the book, where you really come to the why couldn't I or why can't I situation. And could young David say that, or was it just rage and nowhere for it to go?
I think it was rage. I don't quite know why there's a lot of rage and what do I do about it? You know, the health. Well, it's like, you know, when you think about AIDS in the 80s, how angry we all were because nobody was fucking helping us.
Yeah, so, and you were right in the thick of it. You're in New York. You just get to New York. You have an apartment. You're hot-ish. You're getting hotter.
It was before I built myself up that I moved to New York, you know.
Right.
But I was new and you're like, why?
You were young and gay and single.
Exactly.
But before we get to that, can I just ask, because I've had this page in front of me. Please tell me that the name Dale Lipschitz is a real name.
It's not.
Oh. But
I knew a Dale and I knew a Lipschitz, but it's
not okay.
What I'm talking about.
Can you say who Dale Lipschitz was in
no.
the book? In the book.
Oh, in the book?
The character of Dale Lipschitz in the
book.
He's
one of the two guys who beat me up a lot on the playground.
Right. So I'm wondering, when we talk about rage, are those boys on the playground still in your head? And absolutely. Have they gotten quieter over the years?
No. Well, they've gotten quieter because, you know, they've gotten quieter, but it doesn't take much to tap into that anger and frustration. And that story that I tell about in my acting class when I was in college, where we were doing sense memory exercises.
Yeah.
And this is how close at the vest it is. Because we were talking about, I don't remember what the situation was, but it was tell a story about some time when you felt not good, whatever. So I told the story with my eyes closed. And I kind of was the storyteller, telling about how Dale Lipschitz and Gabe Kavinsky would beat me up in class and they pushed me over. Dale got on his hands and knees. Gabe pushed him over. Pushed me over. I fell on the ground. I got really dirty and my clothes. Anyway, so I tell the story and I'm very kind of like just telling it. So then I'm like, okay. And then the teacher goes, David, what were you wearing? Because I was a real clothes horse back then.
Right.
And I went, I was wearing my brown corduroy.
Yeah.
And I lost it because that little detail put me back And so the story suddenly, after kind of telling it like a story, became very immediate. And mm-hmm. I realized how I had never dealt with the anger and the pain that those motherfuckers put on me constantly mm-hmm. through grammar school.
Right.
You know, faggot. You know, talk about don't say gay. I was called faggot for as long back, you know, as I can remember. And now they want to like, don't say gay. You know what? They can say faggot as early as they want to. And they don't even know what they're saying necessarily. They just know that.
No, they never know. Right.
Right. So if you can say faggot, you can say gay and you can and do the tell the good stuff. You know, that makes me so fucking angry. Yeah, I have anger.
Can we tell the story of Stan and Roger?
Stan and
Roger. I guess it's a Sarah and Stan story first. Well, and Stan then a David and Stan story.
Oh, so you want the Stan and Roger, like...
Yeah, that where it ends up. But, I mean, tell the background.
Okay. Well, no, just that it wasn't until Carnegie Mellon, because I had a year at the University of Michigan, yeah. did not have any sex there. Went to Carnegie and was ready to, after having some therapy time, I was finally mm-hmm. able to engage with this guy who kind of was, I thought straight because he was dating a friend of mine. And then it turns out that he was interested in me. So we finally did. There's a very funny story about the first time I had sex.
Great story. Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. But then after that, we kind of like, it went kind of downhill really fast because he was like, talk about, you know, he was like this with me after.
Moving on. Right.
From whatever. So we broke up and it broke my heart. But then senior year of college, I was visiting New York and I was at a party and I met this guy through a friend who lived in close to where I lived in Illinois. So we mm-hmm. arranged on Thanksgiving, let's meet up. We'll go to a show and whatever. So I picked him up. We went to a show. I dropped him off. But before dropping him off, I had sex with him in my father's car. Okay. And it was really fun. You know, see, but anyway, he was living in New York, though. I was still at school.
Right.
So I moved to New York. First week there, who do I run into on the subway but this guy, Roger? And I was like, oh, my God, it's so good to see you. I hope we can get together. He's like, oh, yeah, absolutely, for sure. And I go and I tell the girl that Stan had been dating when
Sarah.
Sarah, we were very good friends because we both were like the castoffs. So I'm telling Sarah, like, oh my God, I'm getting married. I saw this guy in the subway that I met the year before.
It's a sign.
He's so excited. And he's great. And she goes, well, what's his name? I say, you know, I tell her his name and she goes, oh, she goes, he has a boyfriend. And I went, how do you know he has a boyfriend? She goes, I know. It's Stan. And I went, my Stan? She goes,
it's a very small gay world.
Small gay world. Oh,
and
my
P.S.,
God.
40 years later,
they're still together.
I mean, that was what killed me about the story.
Hilarious. If it's right, you know, it's right. And if it's not, I'm usually involved. But
you know, I'm curious. People who, you know, there are people like Sarah and Stan and Roger who I assume have seen the book and they're happy and whatever. Are there people who either you've changed their names or only mention a first name that have gotten in touch with you after reading the book?
I think some people know who they are. Some people don't. And I don't always use pseudonyms. Sometimes I use real names.
Yeah.
I was very careful about how to do that. You know?
Yeah.
And my editor
encouraged. We're going through this. Yeah.
And some people have gotten back to me and, you know, I mean, I don't know that everybody in the book has read the book.
What about the blonde guy in the Jordache jeans who turned into Auntie Mame? Has he gotten in touch with you?
Honestly, I kind of think he's not with us anymore.
Oh, that's such a great story too.
Yeah, he was one of the first kind of like hot gymnasty bodies I ever got to touch when I was in college. And mm-hmm. I thought he was one thing. It is, I mean, but it shows my judgmental quality because when I met him in the bar, he was shirtless, wearing Jordache jeans.
He was your fantasy.
Say, what'd you say?
He was your fantasy. You never.
He was my fantasy. Yeah. And he bumped up against me and pretty much 3 seconds, he's like, let's go to my place. And we did. And we didn't talk much because there was the sexual tension in the air. And I was still kind of like in my head, the skinny, ugly Jewish boy. So I'm like, oh my God, Eros.
I got this blonde Adonis, right?
Adonis, yeah. So I go into his apartment and he's like, have a seat. So I sit down on his couch, which had like lots of flowery pillows and, you know, all kinds of like, you know, everything was just color coded and everything. And in he comes and he eschewed the Jordache jeans and he was wearing a big white caftan. And in the book, I say, it's like suddenly Mame makes her entry. And at first I was a little like kind of turned off by that. And then we kind of got down to it, but the way that I judged him in terms of my masculinity scale, mm-hmm. I think about that now and it's just cringy. But what was funny about it was because I was so kind of bottled up, I did this thing where I wouldn't have sex with somebody. I had to get to know them a little bit. Mm-hmm. So he comes over in this caftan and I'm a little shocked, but I was like, I'd still like to get to know you a little bit. And he goes over to his Barca lounger, sits down like this and goes, what do you want to know? And so I asked some questions that I didn't even care about after a while. Then he came over, he lifted the caftan, I sucked him off, and then, you know, blah, blah, blah. It all went from there. But, you know, I was so horribly judgmental back then, you know.
Well, you know, but yeah, again, you kind of forgive yourself because you have to.
Well, I learned. I mean,
I think we all do that. Is part of the journey.
Part of the journey is finding out, not only being honest with yourself, being honest with others. And, mm-hmm. you know, not everybody's not going to be your cup of tea, but at least you can, A, figure out why, and B, you don't have to be nasty about it.
One thing I know about you is that you are a collector in the sense that you like knowing people's stories and getting to know them. And it is, you have an interest. I will go to see a one person show about somebody I've never heard of because I know there's going to be something there that will spark something in me. We hope. Yeah, I know. That's true. Yeah, there have been times that you've said, oh, I misread this one. Don't ever go to see a show based on a picture.
Oh, no. Especially a one-man show.
Oh, but speaking of pictures, okay. So, you know, talking about timing, the Tom Bianchi story is great because it happened the first part of it happened very close to us. You were here in Los Angeles and you were at the Athletic Club, the long, late lamented Athletic Club. And, you know, guy comes up to you. You're really hot. I'm a photographer. Want to do pictures. And you're like, yeah, thanks. I'm okay.
I know. I say it's like, I felt like I was going to be like Fame with Coco on Fame. Because if you get me in front of a camera, you know, I thought it was going to be that.
But what ended up happening?
I saw his, he invited me to his apartment to look at his stuff. And I was floored by how beautiful it was. And I said, I'm not ready for this. And he said, well, look, if you ever want to, let me know. And I left. He was really great. And then a year later, I was on Fire Island visiting a friend. And who do I run into? But my friend, Tom McBride, did you know Tom McBride?
I did. Yeah.
He was a model and an actor and a really sweet guy that I met through another friend. Mm-hmm. And he was with Tom Bianchi. And Tom Bianchi was like, I know you. We met last year. And I said, yeah, he said, I'd still love to shoot you. And Tom McBride said, David, if you're ever going to do this, this is the guy to do it.
Hello. Right.
So I did. So the next day I shot photos all over Tom Bianchi's house. Did not shoot that other stuff.
No.
And it was a great experience.
Let's PS is that, I don't know, a year or two later, you're in a gift shop with your sister.
Yes. So one of the shots from that session,
an iconic shot,
got into his first book, Out of the Studio. And now I didn't want to show my face at the time because I was concerned about my acting career. So it was from my neck to my knees, hairy chest. I had a beard because I was doing Fiddler and it's in front of an American flag. And it is, that photo is in the archives of Tom of Finland as all American. So anyway, so it was a neat photo. So a couple of years later, I'm with my sister in Chicago and we're shopping and we're at a card shop And she's looking at cards, and I was going to buy one. And I go up, and there's like a little turnstile that has refrigerator magnets on it. You know, we've all seen those. You got like the drag queen with the funny statement and the, you know, the pithy little meme or whatever, the hot guy, you know, shirtless guy. And then I see a photo, a black and white photo, fully nude. And I was like, oh, there's cock. And I went, that's me.
That's my cock.
It was a photo from Tom Bianchi's book that they had leased for a magnet.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of went, I went two places in my head. One, oh no. And not that anybody would know who I was. But then I also went to, oh, that's kind of cool.
Wow. So I and you showed your sister.
I bring my sister over and I go, that's me. And she goes, no, I'm pointing at it. And she goes, why are you showing me some guy's dick? I'm like, it's me. She goes, and she got kind of like taken by it. And I could have gone either way, where this like my real life and this life were coming together.
Sure.
And instead of going to the, oh, it was just something I did, I went, isn't that cool? And she was like this. And so then the guy comes over to pay for the card, you know, I was going to pay for the card. And I was like this. So I pointed it and I went, that's me. As if I was on the cover of Time magazine. And he goes, oh, and he takes it off and he goes, he puts it in my hand. He goes, this is for you. On the house. Like that kind of thing. And we all started laughing and it was so sweet and funny. But that, the reason why I tell the story is because that's where I took ownership of it. That's
well, because your worlds collided, as you know, I certainly would have been
embarrassed and made excuses. It's, you know, I to my sister, to anybody. But it's where I finally, I said for the first time, I'm proud of it. I'm proud that I did that. I love it. And I'm not going to hear anything else. You can judge me if you want.
You know, you mentioned that you were on the Fiddler tour. You know, Patti LuPone has classic stories about Topol.
I sent her the book, hoping she would. Like
Yeah. Well, I would hope so. I'm wondering. Well, we're I would say the cupcake story, but forget the cupcake story.
Yeah, don't go into
and
that.
We'll forget the story of how he would shit on you. But tell the story of Jerome, because it actually goes into this story. Tell the story of the run through in New York in front of Jerome Robbins.
Right. So Jerome Robbins had come to Boston when we were on tour. And he went to see a matinee of the show. Went to see Saturday evening. And then Sunday he gave us notes. And we learned very quickly, you do not question Jerome Robbins.
Yeah, like, there was a girl who kept arguing.
No, but here's the thing. The laugh usually works. And he just went off on her, you know. And Topol was kind of like drawing the show out, doing all kinds of shtick. It was just taking forever. It was awful.
Pulling focus.
Look, he was the star of the show, but when you have a moment, he had so many microphones and spotlights on him that you could barely be seen. So you had to, when you had a line sometimes that was like on the other side, you kind of had to do something physical and then say the line because people were not looking at you, you know?
Right.
So then Robbins came back when we opened in New York and we were in a studio with him. And again, the show was kind of getting, it was like 45 minutes longer than it needed to be. And he really, like, he was on Topol. He was on everybody to get the spirit of the show back and cut the bullshit. And one of the things, like, I was playing Mendel the Rabbi's son. It's not a large role, but I loved it. And I gave it everything I got. And I had one moment in the show where I got a really, really nice laugh that he eventually shit on. Topol, because he wasn't getting the laugh. Well, in this rehearsal where everybody was on their best behavior, I kind of did the moment and Jerome Robbins went, ha ha, like that. And it was one of the best moments of my life, you know?
Well, again, because Jerome Robbins is one of the handful of people that a laugh means something from, you know, me having Joan Rivers say, can I use that joke? You know, it's like that.
Right. When you have such respect for somebody who's such a, I mean, you know, he was difficult and you did not want to cross him. But I'll tell you, the couple of times I worked with him, I loved him because he was all about the work, you know.
So, yeah, and did you end up, were you able to keep the laugh or did Topol end up taking that laugh from you?
For a while it worked. And then there were times when he would just like decide, you know, because he had to participate in the laugh. It wasn't just my laugh, you know, it was something that mm-hmm. he had to let me have a moment technically.
Of course.
It was a moment of time that I needed to be able to say the line, and it always got a huge laugh. And then he would, it was the kind of thing, because he had so much on him, you could start.
Well, he was Topo.
Well, the idea was that I was doing a slow burn that led me into this line that got the laugh. This is technical. So right. he needed to just kind of be, because he's got 12 spotlights on him. Well, mm-hmm. in that slow burn, sometimes he would go like this and the audience would go
and
back.
And now they're looking at you, at him.
They're not looking, right. at, yeah. And so, right. so the laugh technically would not get what it was, because they're like, what's he going to say? You know, and it's just one of those things when you find a moment that you can do together, that there's like the respect of each other.
It's upstaging. Great. It's pulling focus. I mean, we all know. And, you know, there are ways to pull it back, but then you get into a pissing match. And who needs
which happened vocal. With a couple of actors in the show, which originally sure. I wrote about that. But in talking to the actors, they were like, you know what? There's more to it than what you have. And I reserve yeah. the right to tell it in my own way.
Right. And it's my and story to tell. That. Right. I didn't know, I don't know how I didn't know this, that you were in the first few Broadway Bears, not the very first, but not early the in the Broad, but early in the Broadway Bears history, because we've done so many shows about that with Jerry and many of the boys. I had no idea that you yeah. had done it when it was at Splash and Palladium, was it?
I think it was Roseland.
It ended up at Roseland.
Right.
Then I guess there was someplace in between. Might have been. Whatever anyway,
I
see
the book is right. I can't
okay. remember. Okay. But I know the first one was at Splash that you did. So what was that like? Because that you were in on the ground floor of this, and it wasn't what it has become. It must have been a really big deal for you, because in a way it was both of your professions colliding.
Well, it was. It was the first time where I felt like, oh, you can take off your clothes for the greater good. You
yeah,
know?
Right, of course.
And the show was so exciting because you're surrounded. You know, Jerry Mitchell, what I loved about him when I did the first, not the first one that I did, was I was kind of like a background person. But the right. second one, I was kind of the focus of this one number where they turned
you
me
were
into
being licked, weren't you?
Yes. Licked, yeah. They turned me yes. into an ice cream sundae. So, but the thing about Jerry is, you know, it's very difficult with all those dancers getting everybody in the same room at the same time. So we never really rehearsed the number with everybody there until we sure. did it to people. And I expressed my concern to Jerry about that once, and he went, David, I trust you. I trust everybody. And it's true. He just yeah. knew. He knew, he put his trust, because I wasn't really a dancer. So I was kind of like, I kind of kept questioning, why am I here? Why am I here? But eventually, with his trust, I knew why I was there, because I could play the moment that he wanted me to do. I didn't mind getting stripped down and getting, you know, ice cream, you know, thrown on me and whatever. And it was truly, it was like a rock concert. I mean, they were screaming and yelling. It's the best show I've ever been in, you know?
Right. Which is why everybody keeps going back.
And rightfully so. It's so exciting.
Oh, absolutely. I had no idea now, because I know I have to wrap up. First off, so many of my stories began and ended at Uncle Charlie's. So this is a photo that you sent me.
Yeah.
And a lot of your stories. Oh, I do feel for people who didn't go to some of these places, because I do think they missed out, but, you know, that's their problem. I didn't know you worked at 18th and 8th.
I did.
And I was a regular there. My friend Wendy was a waitress there. I think Philip was a waiter there. I'm amazed that I didn't know you back then. I probably did and didn't remember it. And then, of course, there was Food Bar next door, which we also ended up going to at a certain point.
Well, 18 and 8 was during the period after I had done Broadway and started to like think that, oh, my career is going to be growing now. And then I got kind of like, I don't really want to do musicals anymore. And I don't know if I'm good enough actor. So I started studying. So while I was studying again,
I wasn't
working much, but I was working everywhere to make money. I was 18th and 8th. I worked at Raymond Dragon.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Selling schmattes. And I also was a nude model for Columbia University. So I was all over.
Yeah, and in the art classes.
In the art classes, I was all over the place.
You did go many times, as I did, to the Gaiety. Donna behind the plexiglass. $7.
Did not know her name.
Oh, boy, yeah. Well, I knew Donna.
Who didn't love that place?
Oh, my God. And it again, you describe it very well. And I think if people really want to have an idea of what it was like, I mean, that was subversive gay life in New York at that
big
point.
Big time. In the middle of Times Square.
Yeah, the other, and above a Hojo's, you also mentioned, oh, they just went on my head, the two bars on West Side Highway. Eagle?
Spike and the Eagle.
So I remember that vividly. There was also a hotel between that block that you could buy rooms by the hour that had plexiglass on the wall. That's all I'm going to say. You need to squeegee the room. Oh, yes. Well, you had, because you had an apartment nearby.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I didn't need it. I was so close. I was on 23rd between 7th and 8th, and they were on, you know, just a few blocks over.
And I would be driving in on my way from Boston or to Boston, so it was a pit
stop. You
needed
a room. If I was going to find a hookup, I was always the host because I was close.
We just got to show people... I'm sorry, I have to.
Of all the photos I send you.
A young Pevsner. See, so cute. So cute.
Was back when I was trying for commercials.
Yeah, I was just going to say, who is this guy?
They want real, like, characters for commercials. So that's the shot that I took. I think I put it into the rotation, like, 4 times and realized this was not going to get me work.
Well, this could get you work, but it was a different kind of work.
Now, that's how I dressed when I first built myself up, where I was wearing like little tiny tank tops.
String tank tops that we all wore. Yep.
Yeah, little short shorts that were just like, you could see there's like an inch below my crotch, and that's about it.
If that, yes.
Yeah, if that. And that's what I wore.
I don't know what else I have. Oh, you know, there is this.
Ah, yes.
A little bit of leather regalia. Now, this would be about how old?
That's, I think, probably 1990.
Okay.
Or so, 1990 or 91 with Reed Massagill. That's not the act. That's actually from a contact sheet. But I thought that it was really representative of like what I had, you know, how I built myself up, how I was.
Yeah, I hadn't seen this photo.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was even bigger than that at certain point.
I know.
Yeah.
We really haven't talked about so many of your shows, and I apologize to people. Read the book. What can I tell you?
One thing I do want to stress, though,
please.
My editor really, you know, he really wanted what he responded to when he first wrote the book, when I first read the book, was the aspect of the ageism. And
yes, well, clearly. You know,
the latter part of the book, I talk about it a lot because now that I am in my 60s, you know, I see kind of. I'm in my 60s and I'm still, you know, I'm still posing for erotic stuff and I posted and
there is an OnlyFans page,
but also my stuff kind of gets posted with other older guys who are on the internet. And it's very, you know, polarizing. Some people are like, good for them. And some people are like, ew, disgusting, gross, put it back, you know, right. Dress up, old man. I'm sick of that shit. And I kind of go like, wow. Why so vehement? You know, why does some 20-year-olds, for all the ones that like older guys, why are some of them so like, what are you looking at? You know, that kind of thing. Instead of like, not my cup of tea, but good luck to you.
You know, it this wasn't a story I was going to tell, but it just reminded me of something. There was an after hours club here in LA, you know, maybe say 10 years ago, that a lot of my friends would go to, you know, like 3, 4, or 5 in the morning. And for whatever reason, I remember standing on the side of the dance floor, you know, like your eyes are looking at somebody, but you're not engaged. You're not even thinking of it. You're just kind of hypnotized by the music, whatever. And this guy who was very young came up to me and said, why are you looking at me? Like, and I'm like, oh, what was I? Well, back off, man, whatever, you know, whatever. And, you know, it was a year later that he met me through friends. I didn't really put it together initially, realized I was Billy Masters, and suddenly my attention was okay. But when I was just an older guy in a bar, it was get away from me. But suddenly, yeah. Oh, you're Billy Masters. He could not have been more solicitous. And I'm like, you know, fuck yourself. You know,
women have talked about ageism for so long. And I don't think that men, especially in our community, we talk about it enough. Because not only are we ageist within our community, you know, but we're also ageist with ourselves. We project, but we also say like, okay, I'm 50 years old. I don't have a relationship. Nobody's ever going to look at me again. So I'm done. And that is like self-ageism. And right.
What you are sending out. I am not deserving of this.
Exactly. I'm done. And when somebody thinks they're done, they are. So what I want for my book to be able to do is to kind of say, no, you could have 10, 20, 30 years ahead of you. You know, why do you want to shut yourself down now? If you're looking for somebody, there is somebody out there. If you just want to enjoy your life and go on, but feel better about yourself, do what you need to do, but don't shut down.
However, you know, it hurts my heart. To give the flip side of that,
bring it on.
That hasn't necessarily worked for us. Well, we're both single. But
I'm not just talking about relationships.
Well, but you're saying if there is somebody for you, you deserve it. But I think I deserve it. And on the other end, I really don't want it. So there you go.
Well, there you go. And for me, you know, I've been such a workaholic person that my work has always come first, whatever I've been doing. And so, yes, I do want a relationship. But what's the good part about the book for me is that everything that I kind of either regretted, I never really regret that much, or judged myself about. Mm-hmm. I see so much more clearly now. I see it all as part of my journey. And like this guy right here, you know, I'm pretty happy with myself. You know, right. Still a ways to go on certain things, but I finally can own it all. And that feels so good. Even my sexuality and my proclivity to take my clothes off and do, you know, express myself sexually. I express myself sexually the same way I do any other art that I have. And I love it. I fucking love it.
Are you still somewhat of a body narcissist? Is that something you have to battle?
For myself, a little bit, yeah.
Well, for others.
Guys.
No? Okay, no, so you're always harder on yourself than anyone
totally
else.
Harder on myself. But look, part of it is that, you know, part of how I make my living, besides acting and writing whatever, is doing these erotic videos on OnlyFans. And, but I also, you know, I don't have the same body I had 10 years ago. Well, and I'm sure. Kind of more like a dad bod, but I find that's something that people like too. So I don't beat myself up about it.
Yeah, but forget what other people want. Is it what you want? That's, as we've been talking about, that's.
I totally have to stop beating myself up about it. I want to stay healthy, you know, and I want to kind of stay fit. Mm-hmm. But
whatever that is.
Whatever that is, yeah. And
do you think it was a mistake to get yourself so worked out because you ended up putting so much of your self-esteem on that?
I won't say it's a mistake because it was something I had to work through to really get to my authentic self. You know,
would there have been a healthier way for you to do that, or was that the only avenue?
That's a
You're a gay man, and in the 80s, when that is what people were doing to survive.
Right. So kind of didn't know any better. I mean, it was one of the things they say is that guys built themselves up and shaved themselves and everything because it was a backlash against what was happening to men who had HIV and AIDS, where they were starting to waste and they were getting like, you know, Kaposi sarcoma and everything. Right. And so to go the other way, guys would build themselves up and shave themselves down and tan themselves so that they looked healthy.
Right. And it was the appearance.
It was a backlash against what was being thrown into our laps. And so.
And also we didn't want someone to look at us and think, have it? Because he's skinny.
Right.
You know, I was very skinny like you were. We grew up very scrawny. And you worked out not only for aesthetic reasons, but also that was healthy.
Right. But it ended up that all my self-esteem was in my biceps.
Well, and that's why I ask, you know. So but what would you say to somebody today who says, you know, I can't find somebody and I don't fit in, so I'm working out and now I'm getting all this attention. That person hits you at that point in their life. What do you tell them?
I would say, great that you're taking care of yourself. Great that you like what's going on with yourself. But just be aware that you want what's up here to catch up with this. You know how I say, I would say outside I built myself up, but all my self-esteem was in my biceps because in my head I was still a skinny, ugly Jewish kid. And so
would therapy have helped that?
Absolutely.
If it was the right therapist, because you did have that crappy therapist.
I did, but then I had good therapists and I thank them in my acknowledgments.
Yeah.
It took a long time for me to get these two things together to a way that, you know, still like, yeah, is there still narcissism in my blood? Absolutely. But as much as I consider myself a recovering narcissist, there's still going to be that aspect. But I think everybody has some aspect of narcissism in them, even if it's when you walk by a mirror and you do this, you know.
Well, I also think, you know, for gay men, it's heightened because we are attracted to men and we can't help but compare ourselves because we're both men. And that first therapist that said to you, all gay men are narcissists, wasn't completely off mark, but it's, you can't just say that. There has to be, especially, okay, what does that mean and what do I do with that?
Well, especially when you don't put it into any context.
Exactly.
I had to go look up what narcissism was. And it was kind of like, fuck you, that's not me. I didn't, because it essentially meant to me that he thought that I was going to look for somebody who looked like me. But I thought I was ugly and skinny. So why would I have looked for me? I was like, you're off base, buddy. You know?
Well, you know, it's funny. I remember in high school, I had a teacher, an English teacher, who I didn't identify as gay at the time, but I remember having a crush on him. And what it was I kind of wanted to look like him. That was my ideal. And so I think as gay men, it's a blurred line between what we're attracted to and what we want for ourselves. So, it, you know, people don't talk about that very much.
Right. And I guess the whole attraction thing is really, you know, you do want to be attracted to somebody when you, that's why on the apps, you know, I'm on all the apps. I always have.
I've seen you.
Yeah. But here's the thing. If somebody like approaches me and I'm not into them because I just think that the photos, who knows if they're true, there's not enough of a profile. If I met that person in real life, might be a whole nother thing, you know. So that's why I can't say that on the apps that I'm always like, you know, I answer everything and, you know, good luck to you and this. And I don't always, because I'm just like, you know, it's too much. I'm on too many, not only those apps, but on social media. It's just too
right,
much.
Right, of course.
But it doesn't replace meeting somebody face to face, getting their vibe, looking in their eyes, you know.
And connecting with somebody. I think we have forgotten how to connect and how to approach people. Yeah, absolutely.
My whole life, the book is about connect as an actor, learning how to connect as a, you know, as a gay man, as a lover, as a romantic, as a personal organizer. If there's not connection, I am not a happy person, you know.
But if he's paid enough, he will clean your apartment naked and maybe jerk you off if you ask nicely.
Well, that's how it used to be for me. That's how it used to be. And I loved it. You know,
I know you did.
I did.
And you wrote a song about it.
That's right.
I love David Pevsner. Damn Shame, a memoir of desire, defiance, and show tunes. We've seen a little bit of all three here. David, stay on when we leave so that you and I can finish talking. But I want to thank you so much for doing this. You know, I don't know how many times you've been on the show, like 3-4 times. I feel like during the pandemic, it's been a great way for me to stay connected with people who, you know, I don't pick up the phone and I don't text or email, but it's sort of been like visiting, even though now
I see you more than I've seen my family, you know.
As it should be, David Pevsner. Everybody, go get it. Where should they get it? I guess Amazon.
You can get it on Amazon, but if you go to penguinrandomhouse.com, On the page, there's all the different places, including Amazon, that you can get the book. There's some
independent and get the audio book. I can't
and the audio book is a lot of fun. There's an ebook. I narrate the audio book. Yeah,
oh, whatever. Yes, I have the ebook. Okay, just a few final thoughts. Bruce Steele said, it's a nice to eavesdrop on a conversation between two good friends. Gotta go. Bye, Bruce. Oh, Kirk Hunter, who wrote our theme song. Hey, kids. Hey, Kirk. Love Kirk. Speaking of bodies, my God, in merciful heaven. See, now, yeah, like he's more than that. Aaron Quill, of course, said to us, oh, yeah, self-loathing is a huge deal. Well, we know.
It ain't just a gay man thing.
No, it isn't. And, you know, I do think that in a way, you know, women have dealt with this for so long that, you know, it's our turn. And maybe,
you know what? I so badly want, I know it's like a pipe dream. I want to be on The View. I want to talk to those ladies. They talk about ageism every day. And sure. I want to give the man's standpoint, you know?
Right. Well, I think the thing is that we don't have our platform. I mean, we have things like this, but, you know, women, straight women have it. Black women have it. Straight men have it. We're a gay men. You know, black men don't have one. Either. Maybe they That's do right. on BET. What do I know? Anyway, yeah. David Pevsner, I love you. Thank you for being on the show. People go to his OnlyFans page. What is the OnlyFans page?
It's onlyfans.com/RealGuyLA.
RealGuyLA. Well, I remember that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think if you Google David Pevsner and OnlyFans, you'll be able to get to it anyway. And then I have a Twitter handle that's at David Pevsner. I also have at Real Guy LA. That's the more provocative one. DPevs on Instagram. Oh, my God. There's way too much social media for a 63-year-old man. But
we will put some of them on the link below this video. Excellent. David, thank you. You and I will talk after the show. Absolutely. Thanks for being here. Guys, thank you for watching Billy Masters Live. Next week. Oh, my God. First off, I'll be back in Boston. But next week, part two. A return visit from Sharon Gless. Sharon Gless had so much fun with us. She asked, if you watched the show, she said, well, you'll have to invite me back. Well, we invited and she's coming back. So for those of you who said, why didn't we get to the Cagney and Lacey and the Queer as Folk and the Molly Brown and, you know, and her stuff on stage, we're going to talk about all of her professional life next Thursday. Thursday, the whatever the hell it is, 14th, I guess. So tune in next week. Until then, I am Billy Masters. Thanks for watching Billy Masters Live. And remember, if we're here, we're live. Bye, guys.